Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
Hello.
How are you,
babe? Kelly, I'm okay. How are you?
Well, I'm just freaking out because I'm looking at my hand, and you're going to have to examine because I feel like you're going to be really good. I went hiking this morning, and now I'm seeing like a bullseye on my, I know, look at your face, on my wrist, and I'm like, oh my God, this better not be like a tick bite. You have to look at
no,
this.
No, don't even come close to me then. It is a bite. Yeah. It looks like a spider bite to me.
That's what I think it is, too.
Yeah.
All right, I'm not going to be all hypochondriac.
No, that definitely, like, with the little bump and all that, you can put like ice chips on it.
It doesn't hurt. I'm just more scared of Lyme's disease. Look at your face. Well, I'll have to do some internet research. Freak myself. But you know what? It's swollen. I don't think tick
no,
bites
that
get...
really looks like a spider bite to me.
Yeah.
But I am no MD or no right. bug specialist.
All right, anyway.
So. You go check it out, girlfriend.
Add it to the list. Honey-do list.
So I had like the sweetest time this weekend.
Tell
me. So when my parents had moved here when I was about 2 years old from Canada, and you know, they're immigrants from Poland and Estonia, et cetera. Anyway, mm-hmm. So they came out to California. I was still a little munchkin, and they lived in this apartment complex, and they befriended this couple, Claire and Joe, and then Claire has a sister who lived not near there, so and Marilyn ended up marrying Sam. So these two families had children and us, and we kind of all grew up together because we only had one relative out here. And so they were just very, very, very special to us. And then, you know, lives go on and you sort of, you know, all separate. All their kids are living in all kinds of different places. Claire and Joe sadly buried two of their only two daughters, you know, 15 years ago and recently. So anyway, so Claire's husband was in the hospital. He'd broken his hip. And Sam's wife, Marilyn, Claire's sister, was in the hospital. And so Sam had been taking Claire to see her husband, but he moved because his wife moved to a different rehab, so he can't take her. Now, Sam is like 89 and still rides his bike around Westlake Lake. So they're on the late 80s, early 90s. Anyway, so I offered Claire to pick her up on Saturday. I got to spend the whole day with her, taking her to see Joe and taking, she asked if we could go to lunch at Norm's. And it was like so sweet.
Cute.
And I thought about in all my years, my whole life, I don't think I ever spent just one-on-one quality time with her. And she was the happiest, most grateful person. I'm like, I did a really good mitzvah.
You did. You're like the king of mitzvahs.
Well, but that would have felt really special.
That's great.
You know, that wasn't like an easy one. It was like, you know,
it was a big one.
You know, take my Saturday. It just felt so good. And to see the smile on her face. And
it's so sweet.
So sweet. Yes.
Oh, I love that.
Very and the cool. latest... greatest news on Prowler is he had his huge, big all-day chemo thing yesterday, and he had to have his kidneys flushed out with
of
the stuff. So the doctor said it was kitty spa day because he was having like
colonoscopy.
Yes, all this stuff, like hydrotherapy and all this stuff. And anyway, he was eating like a horse this morning.
That's
no
great.
Signs of being like distressed at all. And she's keeping her fingers crossed.
That's
she's
great.
Very happy. His Good. Anemia lifted. So he's definitely showing some serious improvement.
All right. Love it.
Enough about me.
That's
now
great.
You.
Kids' first day of school. Thank God.
I know. Wait a minute. Where's the champagne?
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much. They did so well. Like, I wanted to come in and tell you a horror story. Nothing. They both did exceptionally well.
Taking them off.
Yes.
Yeah, they were happy to go.
They were happy to go. Remy entered fourth grade. He looked a little apprehensive, but then was like, okay, see ya. And then London, you know, did kindergarten. He had already done TK at the school, so it wasn't like that big of a jump. And they both did amazing. I like literally left before the explosion. Like, I'm like, I'm going to leave while it's good and goodbye. And if there's an explosion, I'm far gone.
I love it. But they did go to summer camp right? So they were
the
used to going
summer.
Away
yeah.
every day.
Yeah.
Right. So this was just a different version
so
of that.
So it was awesome. I'm so grateful.
Yay. That's awesome. And your Moosey boy?
He's hanging in there. We'll find out more today. He's going to do some tests and... keep fingers crossed in prayers.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
Aww.
Yeah. Oh,
I love you. We love him.
I know. You too. You're so cute.
Aww.
Well,
all right.
Let's
so
talk about last week's guest.
Last week. What's lovely people. Dr. Linda Duray. Sorry. It's got the little thing at the end that I left off or you left off. Kelly?
My computer's not French.
I didn't
put an accent on there.
That on the
yeah,
computer.
Exactly.
Anyway,
come on.
Dr. Linda DeRay and Saban Hill from the nonprofit organization Children Mending Hearts. And if you missed that, you might want to check it out. There's volunteer opportunities. It's really all about teaching children how to empathize with one another, mm-hmm. programs in schools, and also how to decrease bullying in a very efficient and effective way.
And we were saying how necessary it is due to technology today, where you just need that connection. You need to learn empathy, especially kids.
Absolutely. All right. So you do the
All right.
The
I'm
honors.
So excited. Super interesting excited. Topic today. So today we have Dr. David Lay. He is a clinical psychologist in private practice in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Dr. Lay is licensed in New Mexico and North Carolina and has provided clinical and consultative services in numerous other states. He's the executive director of New Mexico Solutions, a large outpatient mental health and substance abuse program in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Dr. Lay has been treating sexuality issues throughout his career. He's a board certified sex therapist and supervisor of sex therapy, and has published 3 critically acclaimed books addressing the intersection of sexuality and mental health. He's a frequent commentator in media around the world, ranging from Playboy to CNN and the Washington Post. Today, we are talking to him, well, basically about everything, but in specific, his book, Insatiable Wives.
Welcome, Dr. David.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So first of all, just for our listeners, would you explain what a certified sex therapist is? Because I think sometimes people confuse that, is that you actually have sex with your clients.
Do people think that?
Yes, they do.
Oh.
So can
yeah,
you...
Yeah, no. With years doing this, you know, I've never had sex with a patient, never had sex with anybody I interviewed in my book, even though many of them, especially with my first book that we're going to talk about here in a minute, many of them were kind of putting that on the table. Now, a sex therapist is somebody who, you know, has been clinically trained in addressing and understanding sexuality issues and helping people to have healthy sexuality. One of the things that's really unfortunate is that 90 to 95% of mental health therapists across the United States have no training in sexuality, even though sexuality is one of the things that is very strongly correlated with life satisfaction, with relationship satisfaction. Most therapists, the only stuff they know about sex is whether they like it or not. And so what happens is that a therapist will diagnose you as a nymphomaniac or a sex addict if you want more sex than the therapist does.
Mm.
Sex therapists are people who've been really trained to understand the diversity of human sexuality with a main focus on trying to help people have healthy sexuality. It's not that we want people to be more sexual, but we want to help people address and understand the conflict that they have inside themselves and in their relationships, so that they can have the most healthy, productive, you know, positive sex that's possible.
So do you believe that there is no such thing as sex addiction?
No. You know, sex addiction is a concept that's been rejected for, you know, going on 40 years. But there's a large cash-based industry that makes a lot of money off selling basically moral snake oil to people that are afraid of their own sexuality. What the research now is showing consistently, a new study is coming out about every week now, showing that the people who believe themselves to be addicted to sex are not actually having more sex than anybody else. They're not watching more porn than anybody else, but they struggle with a moral conflict. Typically, these are people who grew up in abstinence-only sex education schools mm-hmm. and religious families where they were taught there's a certain kind of sex that is okay. And now in today's world, with the internet, Craigslist and Grindr and Tinder, You can use technology to access all the sexuality and sexual material you want. And if you've never been prepared to manage or understand that, that can be very, very scary. And you end up fighting yourself. You end up feeling like you're fighting your own sexual desires. The interesting thing is, the more we fight our sexual desires, the more powerful they actually become, kind of paradoxically. There's this research showing that if you take religious folk and you try and help them suppress thoughts of sex, the thoughts of sex actually become stronger.
Hmm.
That's what's happening with this idea of sex addiction, is that we're focused on you know, the sex, as opposed to helping people understand the moral conflict that they're struggling with, and then helping people to just figure out how they want to resolve that. It's not by accident that the idea of sex addiction was introduced in the early 1980s at the same time as the AIDS crisis. And it's also not by accident that gay and bisexual men are at 3 to 4 times risk of being labeled sex addicts today, because wow. This is a concept that is really based on very heterosexual, monogamy-focused ideas of what good, healthy sex is.
Mm. So let me just throw like an example by you, because I'm listening to what you're saying. Obviously, there's a lot of it's contrary to a lot of what other people think or what's out there in terms of.
Mm-hmm.
And I completely understand what you're saying, and the context is so important. But taking morality sure. out of it, and a person comes to you, let's say a gentleman in his 30s, and he is at work, and 9-10 times a day he's masturbating at his computer, his work computer, and he's been fired mm-hmm. from 2, 3, 4 jobs, let's say, in the last 5 years because people are onto this, and he feels like he can't stop, and he's not necessarily feeling yeah. guilty about it. It's just he just loves it, and he just wants to do that, but he's losing his job. What would you categorize that as, or try to understand what's beneath that?
Sure. So, you know, first, it's really important to do a comprehensive and thorough clinical assessment of those folks. And 90% of them turn out to have a major mental health condition, typically anxiety disorder or depression. And that gentleman, and I've actually treated that guy probably, you know, a dozen or more times,
okay.
Very consistently, they tend to have just what I said. They tend to have an obsessive compulsive or anxiety kind of disorder, mm-hmm. or they have depression, and they are using masturbation and pornography to cope with those feelings. One of the things that is really unfortunate is that men are not really taught to cope with negative feelings. You know, we are told to soldier up, to shut up, to not express the feelings. Women are taught from a very early age to express and deal with and manage those negative feelings. And as they deal with them later in life, they're more effective at it. Guys struggle. And, you know, guys typically deal with negative feelings through sex, through alcohol, or through fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And none of those work all that well. What I tell these guys, and I say, again, I see them a lot, is it's fine for you to use masturbation or watching pornography as a way to change how you're feeling in the moment. But when you're at work or if you're at church, it might not be the most effective strategy. So what else you got? Mm-hmm. One of the things I do in therapy with these guys is I try to, you know, take away the energy from this negative issue. One of the things that I think that's unfortunate in the sex addiction model, for instance, is that we over-energize, we empower this negative behavior by focusing on it so much. But, you know, when these guys come back to me for therapy, I don't ask them how much porn they watch. Instead, I try to incentivize and energize the positive behavior. I ask them, how much are you using the other coping strategies that we've been practicing?
Mm-hmm.
Things like breathing or things like meditation, things like mindfulness. And I reinforce those. I pay more attention to those because one of the things that we know very clearly in psychology is the things that you pay attention to, you get more of. So if we are obsessively focused on the pornography and the masturbation, guess what you're going to get more of? But if instead you focus on building up the positive resources and increasing the skills that this guy has to deal with the problems in his life, you're going to get more of those.
That makes sense. I completely get that. You're taking a lot of the shame out of it, too. I understand what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. And interestingly, one of the things that we know at this point is that it is two specific kinds of factors that contribute to men predominantly feeling out of control of their sexuality. One is shame. The more shame people have, the greater degree of difficulty they have controlling those behaviors. The second is sexual dissatisfaction. When an individual, again, typically a male, is in a relationship where they feel sexually unsatisfied, it is more likely that the man is going to feel like their sexual desires are out of control.
Mm-hmm.
Those are really important things to pay attention to when we hear somebody say, I feel like I can't control my sexuality. Because then what we need to start doing is understanding why. Because most people don't feel that way.
Right.
And so it's really important for us to understand what it is that is unique about you that is leading to you struggling with that feeling in this moment. That's the kind of work I do. I think that, unfortunately, mental health, because we are poorly trained in sexuality, when a sexual issue pops up, it becomes this sexy, shiny object that we pay too much attention to, and we get distracted instead of using good clinical skills and good clinical strategies to address what the real issue is. One of the things I say is, you know, if I walk in the doctor's office and I'm sneezing, my doctor doesn't say, David, you got a sneezing disorder. You need to stop that. Instead, my doctor tries to figure out whether I have a bacterial infection, a viral infection, or allergies. Mm. Because it's really important that we treat each of those differently. If you treat a virus with antibiotics, you're contributing to the spread of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Mm-hmm. So it's important that we treat the real issues here. And sex, in all of these cases that we call sex addiction, sex is just a symptom of other issues. We shouldn't be diagnosing the symptom. We should be diagnosing and treating the real cause.
Do you apply the same principles then to drug addiction, gambling addiction, or do you just limit that to your orientation toward sexuality?
Well, I am at this point, you know, an expert on the issue of sex addiction. And so I'm cautious, you know, to stay in my lane. Mm-hmm. I do run a very large alcohol, drug, mental health, behavior health, substance use treatment program. And our program focuses on helping people to build resiliency and to build the positive coping skills in their life so that they don't need the drug and alcohol issues so much, so that they can build up things that protect them from the negative effects of those issues. We've been pretty successful at that, and that actually is what the best research indicates. You know, again, 90% of people with drug and alcohol issues have a comorbid mental health issue. And if you don't treat that mental health issue, then you're really taking away something from these people without replacing it with something that can help them be more effective. So my treatment program, when it comes to drug and alcohol issues or gambling issues as well, really focuses on, again, trying to build people up rather than change them or take something away from them. One of the other controversies right now, you know, the World Health Organization has suggested that they're going to include a video game disorder in the next edition of the International Classification of Disease. And there's a lot of challenge about that because the most of the pressure to include this video gaming as a disorder has come from certain, you know, very vested interests, you know, who make a lot of money or use this concept to control people. But the research that I look at that kind of says the most to me was this one study where they looked at people who believe that video game addiction is real, and they found that people who were older, people who had less experience playing video games, and people who had more negative attitudes towards young people were more likely to view video game disorder as a real thing. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that it is or isn't a real thing? No, it doesn't. But it does mean that we need to look at the moral and the social biases that play into this and make sure that we're not letting those things intrude into our diagnosis. You know, mm-hmm. for many, many years, mental health has been diagnosing based on morality. You know, homosexuality was sure. a diagnosis based on morality. Women were called nymphomaniacs and had awful things done to them. Up until the 1950s, had their clitorises removed just because they like sex as much as men. And mental health and medicine of the day, based on moral beliefs and social beliefs, not science, thought that was unhealthy. At this point, we need to be incredibly cautious to prevent these kind of biases from intruding into our clinical practice, because when we allow that to happen, we hurt people.
Mm. This is absolutely fascinating to me, all of this, like this whole topic. I want to switch gears for a minute and talk a little bit about, I know in your books, you talk about how monogamous couples can learn a lot from couples that are non-monogamous, like wife sharing. And I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to that.
It's kind of an interesting story. I mean, it is actually how I got into all this work. I mean, as a psychologist, I started working with sex offenders because there is always work there if you're willing to work with that population. I really had no training on it, but because I had a good poker face, I was, willing to listen and work with these people. But over time, what happened was that, my colleagues who had no training in sexuality as well started referring more and more cases to me of sexuality that was slightly outside the norm, whatever we think the norm is. And, with the last name Lay, they said, well, send them to Dr. Lay.
That's
He's
funny.
The sex doctor. I've argued that with that name, I really only had two options. I could be a sex doctor or a politician involved in a sex scandal.
I love that.
But it's pretty clear Anthony Weiner holds the title, continues
right.
to defend the title of the, the most appropriately named sex scandal politician.
It's true.
So I went the sex doctor route. And I've continued to work with sexuality populations across my career, even though I've become largely an administrator these days. But several years ago, I was clinically depressed. I was banging my head against the wall with bureaucracy, managed care organizations, all of the stuff that makes healthcare very, very difficult. And I started thrashing around trying to find kind of some self-directed project, and I ran a short-lived, unpublished research study around people in non-monogamous relationships. And during that, I ran across two couples who lived what they called the hot wife or the cuckold lifestyle. And this is a practice where the wife goes out and has sex with other men with the husband's enthusiastic permission. And as a clinician, when I first saw these couples, I thought that can't be healthy. But then I wondered why I thought that. And I realized that these couples were actually remarkably healthy. Both of them had been married 20 and 30 years. They had incredible communication skills. They later said to me, if you can talk about this stuff, you can talk about anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that I had allowed a lot of bias around promiscuity, around female sexuality, around monogamy to intrude into my clinical thinking without me noticing. So I kept interviewing these couples. I posted ads on Craigslist, at the time, before Sesta and Fosta, Craigslist had personals ads. And as I would travel for business, I'd post ads looking for couples that were living this lifestyle. And they would send me naked pictures of the wife, which I would say, thank you very much. She's lovely. But I'm really just interested in interviewing you and understanding how you do this and how you make this work in a society that really idealizes monogamy. And at the end of it, I had a book. And that was one of the things that I said was that we can really actually learn a lot about effective marriage and about problem solving, about respect and mutual integrity from looking at how these couples do this successfully, because they are making something pretty difficult work very, very well.
How common, though, is it for, would you call those polyamorous couples or...
Polyamory is the modern kind of open marriage concept, and it basically means many loves, and it is the idea of kind of open relationships that involve relationship intimacy, emotion, commitments and connections, not just sex. Nobody knows how common this is. There is some research suggesting that as many as 20% of people in the United States may be in an open, consensual, non-monogamous relationship at some point in their lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not sure if that's a high estimate or not. the problem is most people don't talk about this stuff because they know the therapist or their coworker is going to judge them for it. You know, there's a lot of shades of gray here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have things like hall passes, you know, that couples engage in. We have friends with benefits. One of the things that we do know is that the younger generation, the millennials, 45% of them don't view monogamy as necessary for relationships. Mm-hmm. And so what we're seeing is a larger growing generation of people who are approaching relationship, marriage, and intimacy in a different way than we have approached it in the past. What does that mean? We don't know. Are they going to stay this way? Are they going to keep viewing relationships this way? Or like the baby boomers who, you know, went through the free love movement in the 70s, and then they all became, you know, Reaganomics conservative folks in the 80s.
Yeah.
Is this generation going to switch? We don't know. But what we do know is that this appears to be a door that once opened can't really be closed, because the internet is now leading to lots and lots of people who have said, you know, monogamy doesn't work so well for me. And they're finding other people who say the same thing, and they're able to make successful, effective relationships work from that honest, open foundation.
So what do you do with a couple where one person becomes open to that and is interested in that? And let's say the other partner is just adamantly, no, we signed up for monogamy. I'm not interested in changing those rules, if you will. And in fact, that would really hurt me and destroy the relationship. He would be, let's say it's the man who wants to open it up. And he says, you know, I can respect that and all that, but this is what I really want to do. How would you handle that?
Well, you know, first, the research is unfortunately pretty clear. People who go into non-monogamous relationships in order to try and satisfy the other partner, it doesn't work. If you have negative attitudes about non-monogamy, then trying to force yourself to do it is a recipe for disaster.
I would think, yeah.
But what I do, and so, you know, I think, you know, these couples where one partner is trying to force the other one into it, you know, I tell them, look, this isn't going to work. But what I do say, however, is there are lots of things in life and marriage that we compromise over. You know, I might be into golf and my wife or partner is not into golf at all. But is my wife or partner willing to compromise and go with me sometimes to a golf resort so that I can play? Why are we willing to compromise about some of these things and willing to negotiate about some of these things when we're not willing to compromise or negotiate about sexual matters? And unfortunately, we treat sexual issues as though they are different from every other human or relationship behavior. And I think that they are in some ways, but in many ways they're not. And I think that when we treat them differently, we're assuming that sexuality is special in some unique and intrinsic ways. Mm-hmm. It might be, but that's a moral and a social issue, not a medical or scientific one. And as a clinician, I have to work from the medicine and science. So instead, I then start to work with couples about, where did you get these values? What do you, you know, why is it that you believe that, you know, monogamy is the ideal, especially when this is your second or third marriage? And so I'm wondering what monogamy actually means to you. You know, I point out that many of us grew up in families that were extremely sexist or extremely racist, but most of us today no longer hold those values. How did those values change? One of the things that happened is that society changed its attitudes and beliefs around those values, and we changed with it. Society is changing its attitudes and beliefs around monogamy right now, and we are slowly changing with it, but we're not noticing. We're not paying attention. So, for instance, you know, one of the issues that many people struggle with is, you know, the role of pornography in relationships. And first, you know, when we look at pornography, we always have to recognize that pornography use actually is code for masturbation to pornography. Because, you know, pornography use, 90% of it is accompanied by masturbation. So when we talk about the impact of porn use on a relationship, we're actually talking about the impact of masturbation on a relationship. So research was done that looked at whether people believed that watching porn was infidelity. And they compared people in the United States to people in Spain. And it turned out that in the United States, if you were religious and had low self-esteem, you were more likely to view watching pornography as infidelity. But in Spain, it didn't matter if you had low self-esteem or were religious. You were not likely at all to view pornography use as infidelity. Because in Europe, and I reached out to the author, and he said, in Europe, they just don't take some of those issues quite as seriously. And we view sexuality as just kind of one aspect of life and not this overarching, overriding kind of moral absolute. So I think that is one of the things that we're seeing change, is that couples are learning to look at sexuality in some new, different ways. And a great example is the popularity of 50 Shades of Grey. Yeah. You know, one of the most popular books in recent history, sold well over 100 million copies, and led to, you know, millions of women acknowledging and saying, hey, I'm kind of turned on by this idea of being dominated and being submissive in bed sexually. It's really pretty arousing to me. And therapists like myself, sex therapists like myself across the country, we had this really interesting thing where all of a sudden we had all of these couples across the country coming to us and saying, the wife really, really wants this experience. She is really turned on and is fantasizing about it a lot. And the husband doesn't feel like he can do it. And for the first time ever, we saw women saying, is there a way we could open up our relationship so I could get this experience? It's the first time we've ever seen women empowered to want or, you know, pursue this kind of sexual experience so much that they were now willing to negotiate the relationship boundaries around it. I think that that is an incredibly healthy and positive thing, because then we end up with relationships where we're not treating each other's sexuality as communal property. We're not saying that your orgasm belongs to me, and you don't get to enjoy it unless I say so.
So curious about the whole sexual jealousy component in all of this. I'm wondering then if this research or the people you spoke to in Spain, if the Spanish culture is just not as sexually jealous of one another, and that's what's driving this sort of possessive, fear-based experience for our sexuality here.
Well, you know, you were breaking up a little bit, but I'll respond on the jealousy issue. In my book, Insatiable Wives, Women Who Stray and the Men Who Love Them, I talked a lot about jealousy, because that you know, that's a huge issue in these kinds of relationships and concepts. What was really, really interesting was that these couples take sexual jealousy and they use it like jet fuel to empower and enliven and energize their sexual relationship. It's just one of the most fascinating things I've ever seen, where these couples that have not been having much sex, and they open up their marriage because the husband is interested in this idea. It always comes from the husband, of seeing his wife with other men. The wife goes off with other men. She comes home, and the husband is just filled with this sexual competitive urge, which is really, at its root, that jealousy kind of core. Now, In many couples, unfortunately, jealousy and fear of female infidelity leads to domestic violence. That is one of the, you know, hallmark kind of warning signs and issues. But for these couples, they took that jealousy experience and they used it to energize their sexuality. And so the husband and wife started having crazy amounts of sex after she went and had sex with other men. Mm-hmm. The argument, at least one argument, is that this is driven by a biological and kind of psychological principle called sperm competition, which is basically the idea that we evolved sexually as a species in kind of an arms race between male and female sexuality, both competing over who got to conceive, who got to control conception. And so, for instance, the male penis is actually shaped like a plunger, such that it works to remove semen that is already present in the vaginal canal of other males.
Wow.
To increase the chances that, the male that is now having sex with you is more likely to have his sperm conceived. There's one really neat research study that looked at pornography online. And so let me ask you a question. What is the most common male sexual fantasy?
Lesbians.
Two women.
Yeah, exactly. Two women.
Two women. A threesome with two women. Everybody always gets that right. It is ubiquitous. 70% of American males acknowledge that fantasy, a threesome with two women.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because most pornography online is designed for men, you would think then that most pornography online would be multiple women and a single man. But in fact, research finds that it's the exact opposite. Most pornography online is actually dominated by multiple men and a single woman. Why? Well, researchers did this really interesting study where they had men masturbate looking at these different kinds of pornography and found that when a man masturbates watching pornography with multiple men and a single woman, he ejaculates harder. His ejaculate actually contains more sperm and he gets erect again sooner.
Wow.
Because his body and his psychology is reacting to these signs that he has to compete against other men. And that's what's going on with these couples, is uh-huh. that they are taking that evolutionary, psychological, biological principle, and they're flipping it on its head and using it, like I said, as jet fuel to power their sexual relationship.
This is absolutely fascinating. We are talking with Dr. David Lay. He is the author of Insatiable Wives, Women Who Stray, and the Men Who Love Them, and two other books as well.
I want to go back, though, to masturbation and pornography when you were saying that that's just...
Let's just pause a moment and say that you want to go back to masturbation and pornography. I'm okay with that. Is your audience?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Our audience is probably captivated at this point.
Do you need some privacy?
No, because what I'm curious about, though, is, I mean, at least for most women that I work with where their husbands utilize a lot of pornography, their number one complaint is that, but that's not me, and I would be okay with my husband masturbating to images of me or next to me, but I'm really not okay with him getting his sexual rocks off by looking at someone else who I might perceive, here's the insecurity part, is that he's going to want her more, he's going to find her more attractive, he's going to not be able to be interested in me, there's so much different, photography and positions and just feeling mm-hmm. just generally inadequate. And that's a huge issue for so many people. So how do you address
that?
Yeah,
and that is one of the things that comes up very, very consistently in the research, is that lots and lots of wives are reporting, feeling threatened by their husband's use of pornography or masturbation of pornography, especially when in many cases the wife is saying, well, I want to have sex, and he's choosing not to.
Mm.
I've seen lots of these couples, and one of the things that we find is that there's one thing that happens pretty consistently before this man and this husband start masturbating to pornography, and that is that the couple stops having sex as frequently. There's this really powerful study that came out just last year, 2017, by a researcher named Regnerus. And he looked at the role of masturbation in couples, and he found this really, really interesting thing. He found that males and females, men and women, husbands and wives, use masturbation differently within a relationship. That men use masturbation to compensate for decreased sex frequency within the relationship if the husband is sexually unsatisfied. If the husband is sexually satisfied, then the husband masturbates, you know, the frequency of his masturbation has no relationship to the frequency of sex. But if he's unsatisfied, he masturbates more when the couple is having less sex. He masturbates less when the couple is having more sex. In contrast, women tend to use masturbation within marriage in a complementary way. They masturbate more when the couple is having more sex. That the sexual engine for women is something that they kind of keep revving up with masturbation. So we have to look, when we see couples, when I see these couples where, you know, there is this dialogue about, you know, what role the masturbation and pornography or the fantasy plays for the husband. These are some of the things we have to talk about. We have to have uncomfortable conversations about how satisfied do you feel in this relationship. We also have to kind of recognize that when we got married, I don't remember the part of the vows where I promised to henceforth no longer be sexually aroused by anybody but you.
Right.
And that is, unfortunately, something that a lot of people assume and don't talk about. But men are men and women, but predominantly men. The research is much more clear with men. Men are more sexually reactive to novelty and novelty cues. And so it's actually extremely normal for men to be sexually aroused by fantasies or by images. And pornography is fantasy made visible. For men to be sexually aroused by these images of people other than his wife. But, you know, we don't hear about men saying to their wives, look, you know, I see you watching these romance movies and I see you reading these romance novels and you really, you want me to be more romantic like the men in those books. But that's not me. Why can't you be satisfied with me? It is a very parallel issue that unfortunately we don't talk about. We're because pornography is such a charged kind of thing, we're much more prone to talk about the dangers of that pornography impact, when the reality is this is a parallel issue that is coming up for all couples. And I think instead, we can help people have healthier relationships by recognizing that each of us are our own person and that we are negotiating and compromising and collaborating in all of our relationship activities. I love to talk about win-win scenarios. And so with couples, you know, one couple had come to me and they were struggling with this issue. The wife was threatened by the pornography that the husband was watching. She said the same thing you just said. The women in pornography don't look like me. Now, she was obese. They were actually both overweight as a couple. So I looked at him and I said, hey, dude, what kind of porn you watch? And he said, BBW porn. And I looked at her and I said, do you know what that is? She goes, no. I said, have you ever watched the pornography he watches? No. I said, why don't you go home and show her the pornography you watch? Because he's watching pornography of big, beautiful women, women who look like her.
Right, right. It's fascinating.
And that's the kind of conversation I want to make happen. Right. Because that's how we build healthy relationships.
We have to talk about this stuff.
But that's often not the case in my experience, that oftentimes
because they're really looking at like models and stuff.
Yeah, and also there's a negative feedback loop that happens in so many couples. That's really, I mean, as a couples therapist, and I'm on board with almost all of what you're saying in terms of the importance of communication, obviously, and all of those things. But we do sometimes, couples get into these traps where there's been so much resentment stored, or there's been other lies, or there's been other things that have occurred, and the sex just falls off, primarily for a woman because she doesn't compartmentalize as easily. She has no more desire anymore. She's not interested. Then he's off doing more masturbation to pornography because he's unfulfilled in that, which then feeds the fire for her because she feels that even less adequate, that she can't fulfill that because she it hurts her to have to break out of her stance that I need resolve here before I can go there with you. And then it's just they're on fire in a negative way.
Exactly. And then at the same time, he's feeling increased pressure to be sexual and to connect with her, and he's angry with her, she's angry at him. And some people can have good angry sex. I will say I am not one of them. My penis doesn't really perform when I'm upset or sad or angry or scared, and those issues aren't getting talked about. But when you watch pornography, you don't have to worry about the emotions of the internet. You don't have to be sensitive to the internet's feelings. You don't have to worry about whether you can trust the internet or not. You don't have to think about the fight that we had last night with the internet. You can just relax and kind of be lazy. And that is what pornography and masturbation is. It is lazy sexual satisfaction. I don't think that's a negative thing. I think that we all deserve the opportunity to have those experiences where we can relax sexually. However, in a relationship, you know, intimacy takes work. And that's the thing that I see so many couples struggling with, is that they think sex and good intimacy is just supposed to happen. And if it doesn't happen automatically, then it must not be the right thing. But the reality is, this stuff takes work, and it's really, really hard work. Now, it's awesome work if you can get it. But people have to be willing to negotiate, compromise, collaborate, and communicate about these things. But we're not teaching people to do that. I mean, I think that in so many ways, what we're seeing these days is the result of abstinence-only education. Mm-hmm. It is the result of, you know, a generation of people that we have taught, you know, that good sex will just happen when you're in love and that you should wait till marriage. And we've taught them nothing about emotional intimacy, about physical intimacy, or about, you know, the reality of living in a world as sexual as we are living in today with all of this access on the internet. We've committed gross nationwide sexual neglect of our youth, and now we're paying the price.
So we're almost out of time, but I have another question. I guess my question is, do you really feel like with healthy communication, non-monogamy couples can be pretty successful in this, maybe even more so than monogamous couples?
Well, you know, again, I mean, I hate to be this guy, but it depends. Because it depends on the nature of the couple. So, for instance, if you are a person who is more agreeable or go with the flow, if you're a person who is more easily able to, you know, view sexuality and relationship as two kind of separate things, if you are a person who is more conscientious and more able to follow the rules that you agree to, then non-monogamy can probably work pretty well for you. But if you're a person who, you know, is a little more selfish, a little more impulsive, who is more neurotic and gets anxious and upset more, and you try to do non-monogamy, it is going to be really challenging for you. And so we have to stop viewing these issues of sexuality as these super normal stimuli. We have to stop viewing these things as these universal one impact factors. Instead, we have to start looking at the way that these things interact with us in terms of who we are, our history, our dispositions, and our context in terms of who we're in a relationship with. If I've chosen to marry somebody who is highly religious, with very, very conservative religious values, it is unlikely that I'm going to be able to have a successful non-monogamous relationship with that person unless they are also now questioning those values and willing to explore a different kind of relationship.
Well said. Thank you, Dr. David Lay, the author of Insatiable Wives, Women Who Stray, and The Men Who Love Them. You are awesome. Thank you. Such valuable information.
Much. Oh, yeah. My God. This was fascinating.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having me. Yes. You know, your followers can find me on Twitter.
Yes.
At Dr. David Lay. It's DavidLey.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And then, of course, next week, a completely different direction.
Yeah, exactly.
Ariane de Bonviosen.
I think you said that pretty good.
Bonviosen. Sounds pretty. Giggles and Joy, Spiritual Life Lessons for Kids. And you can follow us on Instagram at Two Shrinks and our Facebook, The Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show. Thank you. Love you all so much.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.